You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. The astronomy press went a little bit wild at the end of June because of the discovery of an object hurtling in, some might say, from the outer fringes of our solar system. Its technical name, or its catalogue name, is 2014 UN271, which is not particularly catchy, but the name it's been given by others is the Mega Comet, or a Mega Comet, which sounds a bit more exciting. And this month we're going to find out a little bit about why it's called that and what we can learn about it. Later on, I'll be speaking to someone who helped do some of the very early analysis of this object. But to start with, I think it's important to get a sense of scale of the solar system itself. To do that, I'm joined by Dr. Meg Schwamm from Queen's University Belfast. So Meg, welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me.
When we think about the solar system, we tend to think about the Sun and the eight planets. We've of course got the rocky planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth and Mars, the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn, and the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune. And there's a lot of other stuff as well. It's all distributed over what ends up being billions of kilometres, far enough that we tend to use different units. We talk about the Earth being one astronomical unit from the Sun. So the one astronomical unit, one AU, is equivalent to that distance, about 150 million kilometres for scale. So Meg, just to start off with, can you give us a sense of what is out there in the solar system and how big everything is?
The best way I think to think of the solar system is it's got those eight big massive things in it that do a lot to sort of move things around, and those are the planets plus the Sun, right? And then we have lots of other sort of debris left over from planet formation. So the best debris belt that everybody knows about is the asteroid belt, right? Sitting between Mars and Jupiter. And then as we go further out, right, we have basically around Neptune and beyond Neptune is the Kuiper belt or the trans-Neptunian belt, which is where Pluto resides and several of the other icy dwarf planets. And so, you know, just giving some scale, right, we're looking at already thinking about going from, you know, 2 to 5 AU being around where we see the asteroid belt and they're more rocky planetesimals. We've got the Kuiper belt out sitting about 30 AU, already 30 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun, right, sitting out and those objects can go out to distances of, you know, hundreds of AU.
And so to put that into human context, converting from those astronomical units, those AU, the Earth is 150 million kilometres from the Sun. These Kuiper Belt objects are 4, 5, 6 billion kilometres from the Sun. This is a long way. It took a long time to drive there.
Yeah, I mean, if we get some sense of scale, the New Horizons spacecraft, right, left in 2006, right, it took much longer, right, to go over a decade to get to Pluto. So even the fastest spacecraft took a very long time to get out to the outer solar system.
So then outside that Kuiper Belt, we've got that, we think of there being these objects, as you say, around Neptune, Pluto. That's far from where it ends in terms of objects in the solar system. What happens when we think about going further than that?
Yeah, we start getting into sort of even further away. And these objects start getting, in some sense, interesting that we sort of have we don't know there'd be dragons sort of area in the solar system where there might be a planet nine, there might be a ninth planet. Sometimes this region is called basically thinking about sort of maybe in the 200, 300, 400 AU to about maybe 1,000 AU is sometimes called the inner Oort cloud. So these are objects that are planetesimals we know that are on orbits that have been sort of perturbed in some way. We don't 100% know how. One theory is there's a ninth planet sitting out there doing it. There's other theories about how you do it. So these objects we think, you know, were sculpted early on and potentially in the solar system's history, but probably came from more inward. And then much beyond that, we get back to sort of where astronomers feel comfortable out at about 10,000, 20,000 AU, and that's the Oort cloud. And so the Oort cloud is the source of long period comets. And so these are icy planetesimals that were scattered out during the migration of the giant planets. So they formed in a much more compact inward configuration and sort of moved around, scattering planetesimals. Some went into the Kuiper belt, some went out and were caught in the Oort cloud. And so it's a spherical shell sort of that is loosely bound to the solar system, and occasionally a passing star or the galactic tides from the galactic center of our galaxy sort of knock in a long period comet. And so the long period comets we know are coming inward from the Oort cloud. And the short period comets, so things like 67P, so that Rosetta went to, that's a short period comet that probably originated from the Kuiper belt. So those are sort of the main populations within the small bodies sitting in our solar system.
And so you mentioned that a lot of these objects would have formed further in. So that, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, is because the further you go out from the sun, the slower everything has been moving typically. And so just the longer it takes to assemble objects, to get objects to stick together. So that stuff out in the Oort cloud probably didn't form there. Those things that we currently think of as being 10, 20,000 AU, 10, 20,000 times the distance of, that the Earth is from the sun, formed much, much closer in. Where do we think those kind of objects possibly formed?
Yeah, so we think that they formed maybe around 15 to 20 to about 30 AU in distance from the sun. And we have a lot of evidence from looking at the structure of both the asteroid belt and the Kuiper belt that actually a large population within the Kuiper belt were emplaced during this sort of migration of the giant planets. And that same process sort of kicked objects either out of the complete solar system. And so the way I like to think about it is like playing baseball. I don't know what the cricket analogy for this is, but thinking about baseball, right? If Jupiter scatters an object, it usually hits a home run and knocks it out of the solar system. But if Neptune scatters something, it's less massive. It either ends up in the Kuiper belt or ends up in the Oort cloud more efficiently than Jupiter. So a lot of things that we also were in our solar system, we sort of were like when a toddler gets a cookie or a biscuit, right? Lots of crumbs left over that were kicked out of our solar system, but the ones that survived, right, are sitting out in the Oort cloud or and as part of the Kuiper belt. And one of the reasons why we think that, you know, that these objects didn't form out at 2000 or 20,000 AU or 30 AU is necessarily that Neptune had to stop migrating. And so one of the ways to do that, because it was scattering planetesimals, which moved it, is that the disk sort of got much less dense, and so we didn't form as many objects. So the theory, working theory we have right now, is that objects like Arrokoth, these small co-classical Kuiper objects that New Horizons was able to go visit, these are objects that formed in place that show that there is less material around, and these objects are less massive and smaller and have different properties than the rest of the Kuiper belt. And so we think is that that's where sort of all the objects that are bigger sort of formed more inward in terms of these planetesimals, icy planetesimals, and were implanted into the Kuiper belt. And so by having that drop in the disk meant that there wasn't any way to keep forming planetesimals further and further out because there just wasn't enough material around. And so the theory is that we think is to for Neptune to not continue past 30 AU and keep on munching through the planetesimal disk, there had to be sort of an end of sort of making lots and lots of planetesimals of you know, significant size.
Now, you mentioned a couple of times, you mentioned things like planetesimals, which is, you know, a small protoplanet, if you like, didn't quite grow up to be a full planet. So let's think about a little bit of a sense of scale here. So we have things like the Earth are about 13,000 kilometres across or thereabouts, a few 10,000 kilometres across of that kind of order. And a lot of the rocky planets are about that size. You have the outer giants, which are 5 or 10 times bigger than that. So the gas giant and the ice giant planets out in the solar system. But that's the big objects. Most stuff in the solar system is much, much smaller. So how small do these things go?
I mean, they go all the way down, right, until you get to dust. But a good sense of scale to think of, I like to think about it, is Pluto's what, about something around on the order of 1,000 or so kilometers and across, right? So we think about Pluto, we think in the original disk, there is about 100 to 400 Plutos, right? And so we only know about in the Kuiper belt now, there's maybe about 12 Plutos still left. So it gives you a sense of sort of the efficiency of what things were lost and the sense of scale. And there's more small objects than big objects. So things in the 100 to 300 kilometers are pretty common within the Kuiper belt. And so we know of about 4,000 objects, and most of them are sitting around in that range between, you know, 500 to, 100 kilometers in size.
Now, things that are smaller are harder to see. We tend to see things in the solar system because they're reflected sunlight. So if that object is smaller, it reflects less light because there's less of its surface to reflect it back, which means it's much fainter. And to boot, those things are moving very, very slowly, certainly from our point of view, but also compared with the inner object. So actually seeing them moving across the sky is really hard as well. How do we How do we go and find these things? They're faint, they're slow moving, they probably look like a faint star if you take a picture, right? How do we find them?
I mean, the simplest way is take your telescope, point at a patch of sky, and come back later. So the trick is that you can help speed up this process with parallax. So the ability is that the Earth's moving about 30 kilometers per second, but objects that are out in the Kuiper Belt are only moving about a few kilometers per second. So the idea being is that you can use the fact that the Earth's moving so much faster to see the reflex motion of these planetesimals in the opposite direction, because you basically, just the same way as you put your hand over one of your eyes, right, and look at something in the distance, you see it shift. Because of your perspective, your eye changed, which one you saw through, you can do that with the Earth. So what most astronomers do is we point at some patch in the sky that is perpendicular to where the Earth's motion is, to get that maximum effect so that we can see those distant planetesimals move fastest. And then we come back later and you look for the star-like object that moved between those two images. And sometimes they're not star-like. So particularly for comets, they might look fuzzy. And they might not look as star-like because they actually, you can sometimes resolve the coma once you start seeing some of the coma, right, which makes it fuzzy, or it even has a tail. So sometimes your thing is a fuzzy object moving on your images between the multiple observations.
And that asteroid and comet distinction, we talk about asteroid and Kuiper Belt objects, these solid rocky bodies, and then we talk about comets, which have this coma, this atmosphere, and as you say, maybe this tail of material that's being pushed off by sunlight and by gases escaping. We now think there's much more of a grey area between these kind of objects, don't we?
Yeah, I think it's, I think we used to all think that they were separate populations. And a lot of it comes back to thinking about some of these are all related in that they had the same parent population, but sort of different histories. And so maybe the better word is active objects. So even in the asteroid belt, they started to discover asteroids that have tails or coma, that you look like comets if you didn't know better, but are on asteroid-like orbits. And they think that that might have to do something with buried water ice being sublimated. I think is maybe the better word to say is we have active objects in the solar system, and comets are one type, right? And we have long period and short period, and these are objects that come from very specific populations where we also have activity in the asteroid belt. So yeah, it's been fun to see this sort of gray area. And then there's also this other population, which is smaller, I neglected to talk about, which is the centaurs. And these are also escaped Kuiper Belt objects that are leaking into the middle solar system. And some of these objects actually become active. And so are they short period comets? Well, not quite by the definition needed for the orbit, but they occasionally do seem to become active. And it looks like it's a different process from what we see for comets. So for most traditional short period, long period comets, what we're seeing is sublimation of water ice and other volatiles. And some of these other populations that are active objects or seem to have potentially coma or tails occasionally seems to be different processes that are potentially driving that. So yeah, I think things have gotten grayer. Or maybe there's more color. Maybe there's more color. Yeah. Maybe it's the best way to think about it. There's more colors in the crayon box to color the solar system with these days.
It's certainly not black and white anymore. Whether it's gray or colorful, it's not black and white, I think is the key thing, isn't it? So we've gone from thinking about these rocky objects or these icy objects, which are the comets, to thinking about everything. Everything is generally a mishmash of rock and ice, and it might just be where that ice is, different quantities, different proportions of those different materials. That comes to the distinction, I guess. Well, this brings us on to, speaking about active objects and comets and so on, this brings us on to the object that's been in the news recently, which is, as I said, it went by the name of 2014 UN271. And it was actually only discovered in data very recently, in fact, in June this year. The announcement was made of its discovery using archival data. We'll come back to Meg shortly, but it's time now to speak to Dr. Tim Lister from Las Cumbres Observatory, who made some of those early observations of this object. And I began by just clarifying with Tim that he didn't actually discover it originally, but he has been involved in the early analysis.
Hi there, Chris. Thanks for having me on. No, we weren't the original discoverers of this object. It was actually found by two folks called Bernardelli and Bernstein, who found this object looking through data from the Dark Energy Survey, which is a camera that's mounted on the 4-meter telescope down in Chile. They discovered this in the sort of middle of June, and as a lot of observations seem to get announced these days. This came out on Twitter as a new exciting object in the outer solar system, as you say, and we decided we would go point at the telescopes of Las Cumbres Observatory at it to see what it was up to.
So you mentioned they found this in a survey from the Dark Energy survey in images. So this is images that have been scanning the sky, actually looking for distant galaxies, but they find other stuff in the way, including stuff in our solar system. There's a lot of surveys that do this kind of thing. We find quite a lot of objects out there, you know, hundreds, thousands per year of new objects out there are discovered. Why this one? What made you pick this one out of the hundreds or thousands that are discovered every year to focus on?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the prime aim of the Dark Energy Survey is to look at very distant extragalactic objects, but you can also do a reprocessing of the data to try and look for closer objects inside our solar system, and that's what Bernardelli and Bernstein were doing. And so they just got through a second reprocessing of all of the images that they'd taken, and they discovered this new moving object. And from their observations, we could tell that this was, you know, an object that was on a very long orbit, and it was still a very long way out in the solar system. And from the brightness that they could tell in their images, it looked like this was going to be a very big object. And usually objects like this that are coming in from the solar, you know, nearly always are comets, but they didn't see any evidence of activity around it. It just looked like a moving point of light, like an asteroid or another trans-Neptunian object that's out there beyond Pluto and beyond Neptune.
So when you say it seemed to be quite big, how big are we talking?
So we don't really have a good handle on it just yet, because we don't have an idea of what the albedo is. So we don't really know how reflective the object is. And so it could be a small object that's very reflective if it was covered in ice. If it is like a typical comet, which usually have reflectivities about 4%, so they're incredibly dark, they're darker than like coal. It could be a very big object indeed. It could easily be well over 100 kilometers in diameter, which would make it at least three times bigger than the biggest comet we know about before, which was Hale-Bopp back in 1995 to 1997.
And so we've been calling it a comet because when you took observations of this with the Las Cumbres Observatory telescopes, you found that the initial observations seemed to imply it didn't have any cometary activity, seemed to be a point of light, a solid object. Whereas your observations showed something different, didn't they?
Yeah, so the images that Bernardelli and Bernstein had from the Dark Energy Survey were all taken between 2014 and 2018, and nobody had seen this object because it was, you know, a brand new discovery in between. And in their images, yeah, there was no evidence of activity. But the nice thing we have with Las Cumbres Observatory is we have a fleet of robotic telescopes all over the world, including in the southern hemisphere, which is where this object is at the minute. So we could very quickly get observations with our telescopes, and in particular it was one of our 1 meter telescopes that's down in South Africa. And when we first so those images came in about 9 p.m. in the evening on Monday, June the 22nd. And one of our collaborators on this project that we have looking for comet outbursts, she's based in New Zealand, had taken a look at the data and said, you know, this thing looks fuzzy. It's not, you know, it looks like a comet. It doesn't look like an asteroid. And we all got very excited at that point.
So what does this mean for this object coming in? I mean, how close is it going to get to the sun, and what should we expect over the coming years?
So this is the unexpected thing about it, and why so people are sort of trying to, you know, call it a sort of mega comet, because this object is still really far out. It's out at 20 astronomical units, so it's more than double the distance from the Sun to Saturn. It's still a long way out in the solar system, and normally we don't expect objects to be active out there. You normally need to get them in closer to the sun for them to warm up, for them to become active and start producing activity in a coma. And so that was the big surprise about this, that it was going to be active this far out. It's not actually going to come in very far. Its closest approach to the sun, what we call perihelion, is going to be out beyond Saturn. So this is not going to become a giant, super bright naked eye comet like some of the ones we've had in the past. But because it doesn't come to perihelion until January 2031, we've got a heck of a long time to study this object as it gets in closer, and we can see what it actually does.
So it's from this sort of reservoir of comets out there, and we do have those that come in, but this, as you said, this is very large. It's very unusual. Is this going to tell us much over the next 10 years? What big questions do astronomers have about this object and objects like it over the next decade or so?
So comets like this one are, and the other ones that are out in the Oort cloud, they're really fossil records and remnants that are left over from when the solar system and the planets formed. So some of them, particularly if they have not been into the solar system before, they're really sort of pristine records of what the early stages of the solar system over 4 billion years ago was actually like. This one is also, because it's so big, and it's one of the, it's the biggest one we've sort of seen in sort of recorded history. And it's really going to sort of tell us a lot more about how the activity on these sort of comets gets started and how it evolves as the comet heats up, and then as it goes through its closest approach to the sun and goes back out again, whether the activity shuts off again. It'll give us a much better idea of what the comet's sort of made of and how they change and evolve with time.
One of the things that people have talked about in the future is missions to go and observe objects coming in from afar. In fact, one that the European Space Agency have been planning, ESA, is the Comet Interceptor mission, which is designed to go and find objects that are flying in from very far away. Is this the target Comet Interceptor could think about going after towards the end of this decade?
Unfortunately, not in this case. The object is going to be too far out in the solar system for the spacecraft to be able to reach. But Comet Interceptor is exactly designed to find and study one of these types of objects that's coming in from the outer solar system. And so that mission is undergoing planning and development right now. And one of the things we're trying to do with the LOOK project at Las Cumbres is to study some other of these types of comets that are coming in and to get a much better idea of how their activity turns on and how it increases and decreases with time as preparation for the Comet Interceptor mission. So the engineers and the scientists involved in that mission will have a better idea of what they're going to get when they find a suitable target for that mission.
So thanks to Tim for that. Now, Meg, back to you. We've got this object that's, I said, hurtling, sometimes talked about as hurtling in from the outer solar system. It's not actually going particularly quickly, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. It's on a very long orbit, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think what's exciting about it is that in terms of human timescales, it's moving fast enough. So we're seeing it about 20 AU, 20 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun, but it's going to move in another 10 AU over the next decade. And what I think is really exciting is that in terms of people timescales, it means we get to monitor this object as it comes inward and see how it behaves, right? And so how does this object, which is bigger than many of the comet, short period comets or long period comets we've seen, what it does. And I think that's the exciting bit, is that, over human timescales, 10 years is nothing in terms of the age of human civilization. Just sit there with your popcorn and hopefully your telescopes and watching to see how something this size behaves as it's probably the, one of the first times in a long time that it's, this icy object has been exposed to the sun's radiation. And warmth at such distances.
How important do you think it is that this object is so large, potentially 100 kilometres across? Though I'm sure those estimates will change as more data is taken, because that seems to me to be much bigger than most comets, which are maybe, I guess they maybe get to tens of kilometres across typically, the bigger ones we know of.
Yeah. So it also depends on your context of what you study in the solar system. So we know of, it's not so unusual in the sense that Comet Hale-Bopp was about, I think, 40 to 60 kilometers. So 100, 160, I think, are some of the estimates rattled around, is very big. But I guess is when you look at it in that context, we found things that are about half the size. So it's doable. But in terms of most of the comets, yes, they're much, much smaller typically. But if we think about where this object originally came from in terms of its parent population, it came from the proto-Kuiper belt, right? And the Kuiper belt, I spend most of my time studying objects 100 kilometers, 200 kilometers, 300 kilometers. So for me, I'm like, I know they were in the planetesimal disk because those objects were put into the Kuiper belt, right? And so if they were put there, they had to clearly be put into the Oort cloud. So it's exciting. It's a large object. But it's not so exciting in terms of the rest of the solar system context. We're like, yeah, of course there should be objects out there. Sort of makes me feel better going to bed at night because I'm like, where are those objects? We should be seeing them, right? Because if I can see them in the Kuiper belt, clearly some of them had, there's much more of those than, you know, that there should be some of them in the Oort cloud. So it's sort of nice to see some of our theories sort of coming to fruition in that we should expect to see occasionally some objects of this size. Now, what that exactly tells us of how many objects of this size there are in that original planetesimal disk is going to be exciting. And I think people will start trying to model that and understand that by understanding, right, the survey that discovered it, as well as understanding, you know, what are the limits from other people that have been trying to find a long period and short period comets.
I mean, I think this object, for example, you said, you know, where are they and where are all the other objects that presumably have done something similar to this 2014 UN271? And I guess one way of thinking about that is that this object is on an orbit that takes it a few million years to go around the sun, to loop out the Oort cloud or wherever it's going and loop back in again. And it spends a couple of decades at a distance by which we could easily observe it. Maybe a few decades, maybe 50 years or something by the time you add in it going a little bit further out. So 50 years out of, you know, a few million is only a tiny fraction of its life. So if there are other objects like this, there's a huge chance that they're there, but just still way out in, you know, way, way, way further than we could possibly hope to observe them. So does one object give you a handle on how many there are? You say it helps you sleep at night because you know there's at least one, so you're not going completely mad. But are you waiting for the second one to really be able to constrain this?
I mean, I think with one, you can always do something. Two, the joke is, right, now you've got a population, so now you can compare them. What I think it really bodes well for is Rubin Observatory. So Rubin Observatory is this telescope that's being built in Chile in Cerro Pachón, and it's about an 8.2 meter telescope with about a 10 degree imager. So it's many, many, I think 20 or so times the size of the full moon, you know, does it cover on the sky. And this telescope is going to be the deepest wide field survey we've ever had. It's going to survey for 10 years looking for solar system objects, among other things. And so, you know, this object was found with a very small telescope, right, relatively in size compared to what Rubin is. And so the fact is that we're going to have 10 years of just looking for objects much further out means that we can see if we can find more objects like this very large oddball long period comet, right, because we'll be able to, you know, the bigger the telescope size, the deeper you can go. That means the further out you can go in the solar system to find these things. So maybe we're going to find more of these objects coming inward. And I think the thing that is really cool about this mega comet is that it's only coming into 10 AU, right? So it's coming into about Saturn's orbit. But that's the story is that we think is that, you know, when you become an Oort cloud comet and you sit out there, you get knocked into an orbit that brings you closer in and you do this dance, right, of slowly being scattered by the planets and galactic tides and passing stars that slowly brings you in more inward to the orbits, eventually the long period comets we know of that, you know, come by Earth, like, you know, Hale-Bopp, right? So I think it's exciting that, you know, I think is finding this one object out sitting at 20 AU right now means that we can hopefully find more of these objects and see how they fit into the scheme and really see how many objects are coming, you know, inward from the Oort cloud and are sitting out at these distances. and whether they're active, right? That's still the question. When do comets become active and why? And so there's been starting to be some evidence that some comets can be active very, very far distances from the sun. And so what does that tell us exactly? What's driving that activity? Mm. Plus, Rubin Observatory is going to be observing for a decade. So while this mega comet is coming to perihelion, we have a telescope that's going to be monitoring it completely, looking for outbursts and changes in its brightness over 10 years. So I'm excited that already we don't have to be applying for telescope time and just sit there with popcorn waiting to see what this object does, which I think is the first time really that we've got that opportunity already built into an upcoming survey.
And we talked about sitting back and relax and watch this with the Vera Rubin Observatory. So that is going to take, unless I'm missing, that takes camera. It's got a camera. It takes pictures in color with a few colors. In terms of analyzing this object in more detail, taking spectra, for example, looking at the spectral fingerprints of these objects, presumably that's going to be something that, rather than sitting back and watch, there will be astronomers clamoring over some of the best instruments on the world and off the world to go and observe this thing in more detail, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's going to be a combination of two, right? So the spectra, right, by, you know, splitting out the light and spreading it out, you get to see what absorptions from different molecules there are. And so you can see whether what's being emitted from the surface. So whether it's water ice or carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide that's driving or powering that coma, that sublimation you're seeing, something is some volatile ice, right, of some kind is likely sublimating. And so we can see how that might be changing, right, as this object gets closer to the sun. Well, you know, the saying I like to say is comets are like cats. You can never predict what they're going to do. So some comets have broken apart and have fragmented. Some have had outburst events where maybe there's some pocket of volatile gas, the frozen gas that explodes in one go. And so we know that comets have odd behavior. And so you'll see that, right, in measuring just the brightness in the images. And so I think it'll go hand in hand. You'll look from an observatory and be like, this thing changed in brightness. Let me go get that spectroscopy or high resolution imaging to see what happened. And that's what I want to know. Is this object going to stay in one piece? It's so big, right? And it's been sitting out for so long. What's going to happen on this turnaround? I don't know, but we know it's happened before, the comets have fragmented. And so I think it'll go hand in hand. You'll go get those imagery, right? And be like, oh, this thing changed, and then get further spectroscopy, as well as people just wanting to see how it changed over time. But we already know that comets are interesting creatures that do different and interesting things. They do what they want to do, right? Just like cats. So so I think it'll be that watching and waiting, plus, you know, scheduling those observations regularly.
Yeah, all your memories back to, is it Comet Holmes, so 17P Holmes in 2007, was it? What was that, 14 years ago, that had an enormous outburst and ended up almost as big as the sun in terms of its atmosphere, its coma getting incredibly large, which is remarkable to observe from here on Earth. We're not going to get views like this of 2014 UN 271, which, who knows, presumably it's going to be Comet Bernardinelli Bernstein, to give it its full title. We're not going to get amazing pictures because it's not going to get that close to the Earth, but it is going to be fascinating to study over the next decade and more as it swings in past or closer to the sun than it is currently. That's it for this month. My thanks to Dr. Tim Lister from Las Cambras Observatory and Dr. Meg Schwamm from Queen's University Belfast. Don't forget, you can go online and subscribe to the podcast or visit past episodes at pythagastro.uk, or you can find us on Spotify. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.